The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org.
It's a delight to welcome Professor Sung-Yun Lee,
who by no exaggeration is one of the leading analysts on Korea in the United States. You have no doubt seen frequent mention of him through the cover of the New York Times, through two op-eds in 3 or 4 months in the New York Times this year, on PBS and a host of other television and radio outlets. He is widely turned to. I would say that it's very fair to say that Sung-Yun Lee, along with Victor Cha and Scott Snyder, those three are certainly, I think, the most widely consulted in the media today. And so to have one of the foremost academicians here is a real delight. Sung-Yun Lee now holds the Kim Koo Korea Foundation chair at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, our nation's oldest school of graduate international affairs, founded by Harvard and Tufts Universities in 1933. And his presence there has been important, both in terms of a step up on Asia, on an already very well-respected North Pacific program, but really bringing Korea to the fore there and leading discussions in the Boston and Cambridge area on Korean issues. Thank you for making the drive down and for joining us today and for all of your kind support. I should add that Professor Lee was with us in Seoul just a few weeks ago for an October 8th conference on the relations among China, the United States, and Korea. So he does have a broad swath of foreign policy expertise as well. But one of the things he's really known for is taking a very strong stand on the human rights issue. And we did not want to let 6 months after the Commission of Inquiry report go without bringing in Sung-Yun Lee to tell us what he feels about where things lie now, how they might progress, and where we might go.
Thank you, Dr. Norper, for that overly kind introduction. Thank you for this opportunity to share with you some of my recent gleanings on this very important issue, human rights in North Korea. Let me give you a multi-part presentation, first starting by mentioning what is pretty mundane, and then moving on to the arcane, a bit of history, and then moving on to the profane, and ending with what I deem to be the humane. First, the mundane. Let me talk about balloons a little bit. We know that North Korea is not often associated with the word sophisticated or sophistication when it comes to diplomacy and public relations. Just this year alone, North Korea has called President Park Geun-hye a vile, dirty prostitute serving the United States. North Korea state media have called President Obama a wicked black monkey. And just in case you're thinking I'm making this up, I can provide you with several primary and secondary sources to back what I'm saying up. And also, just in case you're thinking I'm mixing up my adjectives, profane with the mundane, there's a lot more that's profane to come during my presentation. Yet, despite what we know of North Korea's preposterous propensity to resort to such vile invective, one particularly pernicious tactic, I have to say, worked last month in South Korea. We know in early October there was a high-profile visit by North Korea's three senior officials on October 4th, and I would say that was a prelude to provocations and North Korea's very effective carrot-and-stick strategy to tame the South Korean government, because with that visit alone, North Korea achieved many things in advancing its national interests. I would say that North Korea came across as reasonable, even, and open to dialogue. And by dangling before the South Korean government the possibility of high-level talks and more talks to come, I would say North Korea was able to wrest away many concessions already from the South Korean government. For example, the South Korean government now sees the balloon activists these human rights activists who send in balloons filled with leaflets denouncing the Kim regime, along with other small amenities like $1 bills and snacks and DVDs and radio and so forth, as the chief impediment to reconciliation and to further talks with North Korea. South Korea's point man on relations with North Korea in the days leading up to this high-profile intended launch of the balloons on October 25th, testifying at the National Assembly, said that the balloon launches do not help South Korea's policy toward North Korea. And I won't go over what happened. I think any of you know what happened. There were many protesters, counter-protesters present, as well as over 1,000 South Korean policemen who jointly thwarted the balloon activists from launching their balloons. I would say this kind of indirect and oftentimes direct intervention by the South Korean state in effectively gagging the balloon activists is a violation of the South Korean constitution. Over the past 2 years, by my count, there have been at least 5 incidents when the South Korean government used the police to prevent the activists from doing what they wanted to do. First time over the past 2 years was in October 2012 during the Lee Myung-bak administration, but even during the Park Geun-hye administration in 2013, in April, May, and July, and yet again this October, there have been such direct interventions by the police. I would suggest this is poor foreign policy. It sends the wrong message to North Korea. It advances North Korea's standing towards South Korea and vis-a-vis the United States. And fundamentally, South Korea is sort of painting itself in a corner, thinking that this one-time compliance will lead to improvements in inter-Korean relations. Let me move on to the arcane and offer you a couple of analogies to make my point. Analogies are, of course, almost always imperfect, but if I may invoke Henry Watson Fowler, the king of English usage, Fowler said that analogy is the basis of most human conclusions, its liability to error being compensated for by the frequency with which it is the only form of reasoning available. Well, if the United States had followed Japanese examples in Korea, 1910 to 1945, during the occupation of Japan, 1945 to 1952, the United States may have pursued the following actions. Impose on Japan Protestant Christianity as the official religion of Japan. Prohibit the speaking and the study of Japanese language in schools and impose English as the official language. Conscript large numbers of young Japanese men to come and work in the United States under harsh conditions in mines and factories and so forth. Conscript a lot of Japanese men to serve in prosecuting America's wars elsewhere. Impose on the Japanese people American family names as their family names, surnames, and most insidiously in a hypothetical context, force many Japanese young women and girls to serve American soldiers under the conditions of military sexual slavery. We know the United States did none of these things. The U.S. did quite the opposite, gave almost $2 billion in aid to Japan during those very difficult post-war years, which was almost equal to the Japanese national budget during those years. Pragmatism prevailed at the end of the day, and the U.S., out of its own interests, of course, shied away from pursuing a punitive peace and was quite generous to Japan. Now, the Japanese colonial experience in Korea, 1910 to 1945, is in many ways unique, uniquely cruel even. We know that the Japanese and Koreans share the same ethnic stock. They are like cousins within a geographical proximity. They have a shared past. There's a strong sense of shared historical and cultural experiences between the Japanese and Koreans. It's almost like the British colonizing the French or vice versa. There's a lot of hatred, love-hate relationship, and perhaps that explains to some share the brutality with which Japan ruled Korea. That's why Koreans still harbor resentment against that distant memory, the brutal colonial occupation. Now, there are many similarities between Japan's totalitarian grip over the Korean population and the totalitarian rule by the Kim dynasty over the past nearly 70 years, 66 years or so, under Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and Kim Jong-un. The thought control, the ubiquitous police, secret police, the state armed with a very strong bureaucracy, arms, weapons, fiercely devoted to a skewed sense of nationalistic purpose, and so forth. Had the Kim grandfather, father, and son now, had the Kim regime followed Japanese examples in Korea from 1910 to 1945 over the past six decades or so, the North Korean authorities may have allowed for the following. Allow the North Korean people to choose where to live. Allow the North Korean people the freedom to choose their own profession, the freedom to go to a private school if they can afford it, the freedom to own private property and other private properties. Allow the North Korean people the freedom to marry whoever they wanted, mixed couples, and not force North Korean women impregnated by non-North Korean men carrying babies, not forcing them to abort those fetuses and not kill newborns. North Korea may have allowed freedom of religion despite harassing churches and so forth. North Korea may have allowed independent press, independent newspapers to exist. During the colonial era between 1920 and 1945, there were three Korean-owned newspapers, and periodically there were censorship and harassment and so forth, but those existed 5/7 of that 35-year-long colonial rule, for those 5/7 of the 35-generational-long colonial rule. We know none of that, nothing like that has existed in North Korea over the past six decades. And perhaps most tellingly, had North Korea learned from the Japanese, North Korean authorities may have allowed the North Korean people the freedom to seek food, the right to live. We know, ladies and gentlemen, that North Korea is the only country in human history that enjoyed the advantages of being literate, industrialized, and urbanized, yet to undergo a famine as North Korea did in the mid to late 1990s. We've never seen anything like that before. For a literate, industrialized, urbanized economy to suffer such a massive, such a horrendous food catastrophe. And there is today no doubt that this was a man-made famine. One key finding of the UN Commission of Inquiry report on human rights in North Korea is the section in the 372-page-long details, such a detailed comprehensive report, the section on North Korea's violation of the right to food and other related aspects of the right to life. Pages 144 to 208, I believe. If nothing else, you can all download this for free, as you know. Please read that section. North Korea, the regime's systematic and widespread violation of the basic rights of the North Korean people to eat and to live. I think I've already ventured into the territory of the profane. We laugh at North Korea often. We ridicule North Korea because oftentimes North Korea says outrageous things. Oftentimes North Korea comes across as an abstraction, an oddity. But we know that North Korea is a threat, not only to the region, but to its own people. And this is the real North Korea that we should take into serious consideration whenever we discuss policy toward North Korea. Depriving the North Korean people of the basic right to life, that is heinous, it is profane. Had the North Korean authorities, the Kim Jong-il regime, during the famine years, allowed the North Korean people to seek food through growing food, owning private plots of land, barter, engaging in market activities, or just leaving North Korea, escaping North Korea in search of food, the situation may not have been as dire. But we know today, according to the COI report and other reports, that the people starved not because the regime did not have money with which to buy food from abroad, but because the regime wasted billions of dollars on other things, like building the world's most extravagant mausoleum for Kim Il-sung, like buying several dozens of fighter jets from the former Soviet republics, and so forth. So North Korea had the money to buy enough food to feed every man, woman, and child during those years and beyond those years, but chose not to. So this is not a novel aspect of North Korea's ongoing systematic human rights violations, but an important revelation to many and an important way of reinforcing what some of us in the room today have known for many years, that this was a man-made famine and the food insecurity situation continues today. Last year's UN food report on food insecurity states that 84% of North Koreans today are still suffering from borderline consumption of food. And according to that report, North Korea is, along with many countries in sub-Saharan Africa and Haiti, one of the 10 countries in the world where food insecurity situation is the most severe. Again, none of those 9 other countries in the top 10 list, if you will, are literate, industrialized, urbanized economies. North Korea is really without parallel in this aspect as well. So what should be our approach? Well, the question of referring North Korea to the International Criminal Court comes up quite often. When you think of many serious human rights violators, regimes that seriously violate human rights in the world, it's hard for me. In fact, I can't think of any country that is better qualified for indictment for crimes against humanity than the political entity known as the DPRK. We know what crime against humanity is because there is a specific definition according to Chapter 7 of the Rome Statute. When a regime, when a state on a systematic and widespread scale with intent carries out on a civilian population attacks which include murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, and forcible transfer of population, imprisonment, and other forms of severe deprivation of physical liberty, torture, sexual crimes like military sexual slavery and rape and enforced prostitution, forced pregnancy, enforced sterilization, and other sexual crimes of comparable gravity, attacks against identities, groups based on political, ethnic, national, gender, religious identities, disappearance of person, apartheid. North Korea fulfills almost perfectly all of these criteria. I can't think of any other country in the world today that stands out in that horrific way. So, is it practicable? Can this be done? I would suggest, ladies and gentlemen, it is the very impracticability in the short term of referring North Korea to the ICC and putting Kim Jong-un on trial in The Hague that one day will come to be viewed as the very reason that North Korea would have changed or collapsed. It is the very impracticability of such an idea. an idea that is armed with only righteousness, sense of justice, and an abiding faith in the truth that will one day come to be remembered as the germination of the alleviation of 20 million long-suffering, 20 million North Korean men and women and children. So what we should do is continue to highlight this issue and seize the momentum. We know that the UN and the nations of the world today are much more galvanized than they were last year or at any other point in history to address North Korea's systematic human rights violation. We should not lose that momentum. We should highlight the issue. We should certainly bring up this notion, our attempt. We should make attempts to refer North Korea to the ICC. And the South Korean government and the United States, South Korea's ally, and the civilized nations of the world should unite in raising awareness on North Korean human rights violations. North Korean people have the right to information. It is a basic universal human right. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 19, speaks to the basic right to seek and disseminate and receive information. We should not deprive the North Korean people of that basic right. On a more pragmatic level, we should continue to put pressure on all third country parties, individuals, banks, and entities that, in violation of many UN Security Council resolutions, continue to sell luxury goods and weapons-related material to North Korea. How do we sanction those third country parties? Well, there is a method that has been employed with success against Iran and many other countries, and even against North Korea between 2005 and 2006. And that is the notion of secondary sanctions, secondary boycott. Give the countries of the world a choice between continuing to deal with North Korea, continuing to conduct financial transactions with North Korea, and risk the possibility of being blocked from the US-led dollar system, the global financial system. Give those countries that choice. Trade with us or trade with North Korea. That very effective and invasive sanction, non-lethal diplomatic tool, has not really been tried on North Korea with any kind of serious intent over a substantive period of time. We can do that, and the new bill that passed the House unanimously in late July, North Korea Sanctions Enforcement Act of 2013, House Resolution 1771, once it enters into force, it has to pass the Senate and the President of the United States has to sign it into law. It remains to be seen whether those sanctions will induce North Korea to change in the short term. But at the very least, I think we can expect the U.S. position vis-a-vis North Korea, U.S. leverage to be enhanced, to be strengthened in dealing with North Korea, not only on arms, weapons issues, but also human rights. So my last point, my last exhortation to everyone is that don't believe those who say that there's nothing more to do in the case of sanctioning North Korea. We've been sanctioning North Korea for 60 years. We don't buy hardly anything from North Korea. We don't sell them anything. What more can we do? That view stands at considerable variance with reality, which is that U.S. sanctions against North Korea are relatively weak, very weak, compared to U.S. sanctions against Burma, Syria, Russia, many countries in Africa, Ukraine 10 years ago. There's a lot more that the United States can do, and it's the political will that's been lacking so far.
Thank you. It's extremely comprehensive, and you put it in a broad and historical framework as well, well beyond some of our other discussions here that have looked at the Commission of Inquiry report very specifically and in a 2014 context. I would like to draw you to that and basically say that it does appear that there is a very heady steam here nearby in terms of work at the United Nations, in terms of the responsivity of the international community. It does look as if something in the UNGA would be forthcoming and might be very widely subscribed to, urging the Security Council to take this up for referral to the ICC. The expectation had long been that China would block that with its veto in the Security Council. However, there's also been a lot of discussion that perhaps China wouldn't, because China increasingly does not want to go it alone, and that China itself is dismayed at the findings in the report, and China itself has seemed to be distancing itself from the Pyongyang regime, perhaps demonstrated not least by its second meeting with Bakanay in terms of the meeting this July of Xi Jinping and Bakanay and the growing South Korea-Chinese compact. So do you see this momentum that I'm describing in this way, or perhaps you see it differently? Do you see this pressure being applied? And it seems to be something that has very much rattled the DPRK. Some people have said that this is part of the rationale for the so-called charm offensive that we've seen to try to deflect that criticism. Other people say that we're missing something, that actually that is part of an opening up process that's happened that we're missing, and that we're seeing it from our own lens relative to the COI report. So could you just kind of tell us where you think we are now modern context?
With respect to this phrase that's often repeated, North Korea's charm offensive, inherent in that term, and also inherent in what I just mentioned, South Korea taking the view that if South Korea impedes or blocks the balloon activists, North Korea will return to peace talks with sincerity. Inherent in those presumptions is an abiding tendency to patronize North Korea, to assume that North Korea merely reacts to our own initiative, assuming that North Korea does not have a strategically minded goal, that North Korea is a child prone to throwing temper tantrums, just pining for some attention. The United States has a long history of underestimating Asian nationalism with respect to the Chinese Civil War, with respect to the Vietnamese leader or Kim Il-sung during the Korean War, assuming that Kim Il-sung was Stalin's puppet and so forth. A senior ranking man during the Korean War, Assistant Secretary of State for Public Policy, Edward Barrett, said, "The relationship between Stalin and Kim Il-sung is exactly the same as that between Walt Disney and Donald Duck." That is indicative of this American sense of superiority, which is quite understandable, but also the danger of assuming that North Korea is very simplistic, one-dimensional, and would listen if we were a little nicer. What North Korean diplomats at the UN have been doing in recent weeks, were it South Korean diplomats or Japanese diplomats or diplomats from any other normal country, it would not make any kind of news, and we would all see that they were simply doing their job, doing some damage control, trying to advance the interests of their nation. But I think we maybe exaggerate North Korea's fear that they are trembling behind this human rights campaign. They clearly don't like it, but simply they are doing their job. And I don't think being a bit nicer or visiting North Korea for the UN Human Rights Rapporteur to visit North Korea would change anything fundamentally, that is. What would China do? I don't know. But I think Judge Michael Kirby, the chairman of the Commission of Inquiry, has struck the right tone. In his urbane, gentlemanly, way, using moral suasion, he's been reaching out to China. Judge Kirby has said China is a great power, great civilization, great power, and he expects China to act like a great power. I think that's a far better approach than using harsh language to criticize China or even North Korea, because much of the world, as you know, ladies and gentlemen, remains rather aloof to North Korea, and in particular, North Korea's human rights violations. And if we were to use strong language, it may throw off, it may turn away many people who otherwise might take serious interest in this very grave issue. Will that achieve our desired goal of China going along with supporting this movement? I'm somewhat doubtful, because from China's position, having the DPRK around, as much a headache as it is periodically for the Chinese leadership, makes sense. China enjoys its predominant political and economic leverage vis-a-vis North Korea and South Korea. For China to make the risky decision to do away with North Korea, to destabilize North Korea, to really put some hurt on the DPRK, as many people wished for last spring in the aftermath of China's third nuclear test on February 12, 2013, when the Chinese were really irate, certainly. The new Xi Jinping administration government was very indignant. But indignation and condescension and even enmity for the DPRK does not mean that China is prone to altering its strategic interests in having around the DPRK. Because over the past 60 years, I would suggest there have been many more instances of even more grievous, even more serious insults hurled by the DPRK leadership against the CCP leadership. So I don't expect China to fundamentally alter its strategic calculations in the Korean Peninsula anytime soon. At the same time, I don't think this is a vain effort to try to persuade China, to highlight China's position and China's choices, its decisions, and to put pressure on China to do the right thing.
I mean, in a way, is this not raising the carrying cost on China? Because China is pushing ahead with this notion of responsible global leadership. It wants that role. We see that through the Infrastructure Bank and other initiatives. But doesn't it seem that the Chinese, at least privately, are expressing much more of a distancing from North Korea? Concern, as you mentioned, with the North Korean nuclear test, the missile launch, the situation with Jang Song-taek and his disappearance from the scene, and he was widely considered a principal intermediary with China. And that perhaps the Xi administration is more ultimately pragmatic in that sense. Do you think there's a period where there's a trade-off, where carrying cost is articulated to the degree that it becomes too burdensome?
There will be a day when certainly China will reconsider and come to think, ask themselves, why is the continued existence of the DPRK really necessary? But that stage or situation, I would suggest, has not yet come. And there are many steps along the way. For China to come to take that kind of view, you would have to have, I apologize for using a jargon, but a regime instability situation. You have to have chaos, a shooting war inside North Korea, with North Korean refugees flooding across the border into China, or a humanitarian disaster situation, say nuclear fallout, with health implications for the Chinese themselves. In that kind of situation, I believe that the supremely pragmatic and capable Chinese leadership will see that in the end, waving bye-bye to the DPRK does not hurt Chinese national interests in any meaningful way. The emergence of a single free Korea with its official seat of government in Seoul, a united Korea of 80 million or so will never be able to pose China any kind of serious military, political, or economic threat. China really has nothing to lose. The situation, if we come to that point, will be very different from the situation that China faced in the fall of 1950, when China made the bold move to enter the Korean War. In those days, of course, the PRC had been founded just the previous year. Mao Zedong had a lot on the line. He was universally viewed by Asian fellow revolutionary leaders as the leader, the head of the Asian Communist Revolutionary Movement. He would certainly have lost face if he just stood by as the Kim Il-sung regime collapsed. He had serious intentions to liberate Taiwan, so there would have been negative implications on his designs for Taiwan as well. The formation of a U.S.-led, U.S.-dependent, unified Korean state, this coalition of U.S., Korea, United Korea, and Japan in China's Northeast Asian backyard would have been an unwelcome proposition. And perhaps most importantly, China had a plan B in 1950 in the Soviet Union. If things went really bad, Stalin, on the surface at least, had promised help. None of those conditions are in place today and will never be in place in the future. So I do believe one day China will come to make that strategic decision to destabilize North Korea or to just let North Korea collapse. But I think we are far removed from that point at this stage.
You made a statement, and I don't want to misstate it, that you said you felt that a good deal of the international community has been perhaps aloof on the North Korean human rights situation. And I might suggest that maybe by that you mean the governments, but that we have actually seen a real groundswelling of interest and concern. We here at the Korea Society were privileged to have Blaine Harden here for the release of Escape from Camp 14, along with Shin Dong-hyuk, the subject of the book, who was born into captivity in a North Korea camp, who escaped. We have had other North Korean refugees here over time. And we've done about 8 or 9 programs in 2 years now on the human rights issue.
I'm not talking about the Korea Society.
No, not the Korea Society. But it seems that there is a currency, I would suggest almost a watershed, of public interest in this.
Yes.
And perhaps not enough.
Yes.
Perhaps, you know, our good friends at Amnesty and Human Rights Watch and elsewhere who are doing, you know, a valiant job of getting this up on the public radar need more of our support.
Absolutely. And I'm not digging at any particular party or leader or nation. It sort of makes sense even because this kind of indifference relative aloofness toward such serious human rights violations is what we've seen over the past century alone, even in cases of arguably, on a scale at least, bigger human rights violations, like the Holocaust, like, you know, what we saw in Cambodia and elsewhere. Even the most advanced, most enlightened nations of the world, their response in those situations has been indifference and at times denial. And only in rare instances, after a period of gestation and regret, action. So it's not surprising, although it's truly regrettable, that much of the world has remained indifferent to North Korea's almost 7 decades-long serious human rights violations. But mind you, in South Korea, according to latest polls, almost 2/3 of the South Korean people oppose the balloon activists. Now, there is room for improvement, let's say, in what they are doing. One doesn't need to announce the site of the launch, the time and date of the launch. They do it for publicity to gain attention, which they need because they're strapped for money and also they need more support. But the balloon activists could fire off their balloons filled with anti-Kim propaganda leaflets from unannounced and unpopulated locations. but for the people, the South Korean people, to take the view that these activists are the chief obstacle to improvement in ties with North Korea. That's very misguided. And for the government to, if I may speak frankly, cave to pressure, that only invites further blackmail. We know North Korea's approach to international relations and relations with Seoul has been very unconventional. North Korea has threatened to blow up the Blue House many times. 2 years ago, North Korea threatened to blow up major South Korean media outlets. North Korea has tried and at times succeeded in assassination attempts against activists in South Korea. So, you know, taking a step back and caving on this particular, you know, issue will not fundamentally alter the equation, will not get North Korea to approach South Korea and talks with South Korea in a different light.
Aside from the balloon activists, though, we have had Ambassador Lee for Human Rights, Lee Jung-hoon here, formerly of Yonsei. He has taken here at the Korea Society a very strong stand saying that the South Korean government is taking this very seriously, that the secretariat will produce results, that he feels that the government is not naive on these issues, that trying to strike a balance for trust politik is one thing, but that actually quite a bit more will be done. I guess in that context, I would also mention that the Asan Institute has a new report out linking COI to issues of North Korean labor and where it is around the world, issues of slavery. That's quite fascinating. Is there a broader current among those of influence in Korea that is saying this is a serious issue? We have been affected by these testimonials, by Michael Kirby's presence and the jurist, that there has been a difference made, and then what is the next step? To grow it in universities, to grow awareness the way the anti-apartheid campaign was done? Or?
The next step, next several steps maybe, well, to begin with, for President Park Geun-hye or the foreign minister, a high-ranking South Korean official, to explicitly call on the DPRK to dismantle its many insidious political prisoner concentration camps. No South Korean leader to date has done that. No American president to date has done that. And much to his credit, Secretary of State John Kerry was the first high-ranking, famous, influential U.S. official to do that. So that would be a start. Also, I really don't know, Steve, but I doubt many South Koreans have read the UNCOI report. There's not even a UN-sanctioned official translation. There is a translation, a copy, that was translated by KINU, Korea Institute for National Unification. But again, with respect to this issue, the public at large remains ignorant of this, of the contents of the COI report. I think the South Korean government and the U.S. government can do a lot more to disseminate widely the contents of the COI report. And I think that would be a step in the right direction. Again, I'm not here to criticize any particular party or government. I'm just saying this is the trend, and we can do. There are many things we can do to move away from the trend that we've been trapped in over the past several decades and move in the right direction.
Professor Sung-Yun Lee, thank you very much. A round of applause for Professor Lee.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before presenting a special gift, I did also want to thank a few other people. I see Lee Snyder here of our board. Thank you, Lee, for Rudd Potts and your presence, Rudd, as well. I would like to thank very much Stephanie Lee for all of her efforts here with this series. And we have two more, one next Friday with Bill Newcomb, whom some of you know, formerly of the UN Experts Panel at the United Nations. He will talk about facts and fiction behind sanctions, and he has said he will be speaking very forthright in his private capacity now. So if you are interested in the sanctions issues, please do come next Friday at noon. And then in 2 weeks, we have John Park of Harvard University, who will be here to talk about China-North Korea relations. He last appeared on that issue here about 2 years ago, and he's done a lot of work on some updated research, and I'm sure you will find him very interesting for those of you keen on the nexus of the PRC and the DPRK. Those are the two final sessions in the series called The Analysts. Next Thursday night, we have our wonderful Juilliard at the Korea Society performance at 6 p.m. That's part of our Global Korea Initiative. And then on December 5th, we have Ambassador Stephen Bosworth here as part of our Legacies in U.S.-Korea Relations series. And he will be reflecting, very frankly, on his love of Korea, his devotion over the years, and the challenges and opportunities of the positions that he has held in making such a difference in Korea-U.S. relations. So please join us for that. Please do consider becoming a member if you are not already. You can find membership material or application as well as general program information at koreasociety.org, or see one of our development team members after this and they'll sign you up. I'd also like to thank in closing Peter Stemke, who does all of our wonderful audiovisual work here and puts a lot up online. So please do refer this podcast in either audio or YouTube video format to any of your friends interested in this issue. And finally, again, Professor Sung-Yoon Lee, thank you. Thank you for making the travels from Boston. Yes. And, you know, we presented you with books before. I know last time I had a chance in private to pass along a copy of Gregory Henderson's wonderful books, Politics of the Vortex, which was a first edition. You happen to have been close to the family, and I know that had a resonance. I was trying to think of something for you today that might have a resonance and something special. We've had an initiative here at the Korea Society for about a year of collecting veterans materials, items from the war. Actually, I purchased this, not the society, but this is actually a veteran's flag brought back, a flag of the ROK that was brought back by a U.S. veteran. And I very much wanted you to have this as a keepsake for your study at the Fletcher School. And in thanks for all of your kind support, both individually, academically, and as a member of the board of the Kim Koo Foundation, which has been so very kind to the Korea Society as well. So thanks. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. And we hope to see you all again. Please do see Lee Snyder's collection in our gallery if you have time.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.